Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Tonight we're presenting you a pre-taped program that I did this past Friday morning at Sotheby's. Sotheby's currently has two exhibits, Important Judaica and Israeli International Art. The auctions for both these exhibits will be on Tuesday. The auction for both these exhibits, for all the items here, and believe me, having spent quite a few hours here yesterday and again today, I can tell you that the items are incredible. And the prices, quite often surprisingly low. The auction will be on December the 17th. With us now are David Wachtel, consultant on Judaica, on books and ceremonial art. And later on we will be speaking with Jennifer Roth, the Senior Vice President of Sotheby's New York, who specializes in fine arts. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Chaim. It's good to see you again.
It's always a pleasure talking to you. I learn a lot from you every time I see you. Now, as I look through the exhibit, there are quite a few interesting sforim, and I even saw a Karaite Mahzor, and interestingly enough, on the Karaite Mahzor, they had it open to a tefillah for Shiva Be'av. What is the significance to them of the Shiva Be'av as opposed to us, the Tisha Be'av?
Well, according to the historical sources, the destruction of the temple, the first, if you wanted to imagine yourself in the days of the destruction of the temple, the first flaming arrows that began the destruction, the inception of the destruction begins already on the 7th of Av, and so, and those events are actually corroborated in the traditional sources as well. And for a variety of reasons, the rabbis chose to commemorate the destruction of both the first and second temple on the 9th of Av. But the Karaites, who don't hold by much of what the rabbis have said and hold not at all by the Talmudic discourse, chose to commemorate the 7th of Av. It's interesting. There's manuscript evidence that shows us that as late as the 15th century, there were some places where the 7th of Av was still being commemorated by Karaites, and in some cases, to a certain extent, by Jews as, if not the day of the destruction of the temple, obviously as part of the commemoration of the events of the week before Tisha B'Av or the 9 days.
Very interesting. Like I said, I always learn something from you. Among some of the other interesting sforim I saw was Meshal HaKadmoni, which is a book of parables and using quite often animals as the characters. Could you tell us something about it?
Meshal HaKadmoni was written by Isaac Ibn Shahula in the 13th century. A Jewish scholar who was concerned that much of the homiletical material that Jews were being exposed to had its sources in Arabic and Indian, Far Eastern material, and was looking to put some of these traditional stories into a more Jewish milieu. So many of the fables and tales that appear in Meshal HaKadmoni do in fact have their earlier origins in materials from the Indian subcontinent, or in Arabic, in tales from the Arabian Peninsula. And through the work of Ibn Shahula, we begin to see a Hebraization and a Judaization of this genre of fables. Because Ibn Shahula was interested in creating an accessible version. Ibn Shahula was interested in creating a version of these fables and moralistic tales that would be accessible to Jews in their own milieu.
I also see that we have the first known printed edition of the Talmud Yerushalmi by Bomberg. What can you tell us about it?
When Daniel Bomberg, a Christian printer from Antwerp, undertook the printing of the Talmud in the beginning of the 16th century, he began printing the Babylonian Talmud in 1519 and completed it in 1523, but immediately afterwards realized that there was yet another part to the Talmudic tradition, albeit a less famous part, and that is the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi has as its base the same Mishnah, the same underlying text as the Babylonian Talmud, but the exegetical material developed by the rabbis of Palestine in the post-Mishnaic period differed from that of their colleagues in Babylonia. And they treated different subjects. They were much more concerned with certain areas of agriculture, for example. Bamberg, who throughout his career sought out the best available manuscripts, undertook to find a manuscript of the Yerushalmi, and it turns out that at that time there were only imperfect manuscripts available, but Bamberg and his editor, Ibn Adoniyahu, went and created what essentially is the Textus Receptus for today of the Yerushalmi by collating the various manuscripts that were available. And we owe him a great debt of gratitude, because were it not for this, it's quite possible that the text of the Yerushalmi would not have survived through the late Middle Ages and early modern period.
Well, in general, Bamberg has done us a tremendous service. First of all, a Jew was not allowed to print, but as a Christian, he could get all the permission, and he still got all the gedolim of the age, for example, his Mikros Gedolos, and so on. So, yes, occasionally you do find a Christian that, as Jews, we can be very grateful to. Now, let's talk about some of the other interesting boring. For example, the Midrash Tehillim.
The one of the early books, when the Jews went to Constantinople, many Jews went to Constantinople in the 15th and 16th century as a result of the increasing difficulties in Spain, and then after the Spanish expulsion and the expulsion from Portugal in 1497, many Jews went to the Ottoman Empire. It was primarily in Constantinople where they were able to set up printing presses, and early printings from Constantinople are in fact quite important for the history of Jewish printing. In fact, this sale, before I even tell you about the Midrash Tehillim, I'll tell you that this sale includes a copy of the Arba Turim printed in Constantinople in 1493. It's in fact, this Hebrew book, the Tur, is the only incunable, the only work printed before 1500 outside of Christian Europe, and it was printed by the Ibn Nachmias brothers in Constantinople. And it's the famous Arba Turim. Mm-hmm. So that's here in this sale. But in addition, we have other works, including, as you mentioned, the Midrash Tehillim. The Midrash Tehillim, interestingly, on the title page, it doesn't say Tehillim with a hey. It says Tehillim with absent a hey. And we find that actually in some sources, that is the plural of a single psalm, is Tehillim. So it's interesting. It only goes, the Perushim on, the Midrashim on Tehillim in this work only go through Kuf Yud Tet, only through Psalm 119, and it's not for several decades when the Midrashim on the subsequent remainder of Psalms is assimilated. This book, which is relatively small in page count, took over 2 years to print because of the change of the sultan. One sultan died, and then permission needed to be gotten from the governor of the new sultan, so that some books are printed, some very, very thick books we see are printed in a very relatively short time. This very relatively small book took 2 years to print.
But so I see that the Yiddish speakers actually have a very good source for calling it Tehillim instead of Tehillim.
Yes, they do.
What are some of the other interesting books that are on display?
This sale features three different examples of works that we are currently in possession in this building, in this room, of the only copies known in the world. One is a very, very rare edition of Tehillim with a Ladino translation, uh-huh, printed in Salonika in 1583. No other copy is known. Even our copy is not complete, but it is the only surviving example. We have a previously unknown Sidur Tehillim and Ma'amadot, beautiful miniature edition from Amsterdam in 1668 that, again, is unknown to any the bibliography community. When we discovered it, we were jumping for joy, because it's to find something that is unknown, that is obviously the only remaining copy, is very, very scarce. And curiously, we also discovered that we have in this sale the very first Dutch language edition of the work Hope of Israel, Mikveh Yisrael by Menashe ben Israel, and it was printed in 1660. Most bibliographers had always believed that the first edition of the Dutch Hope of Israel was in 1664, but it turns out there was an earlier edition, and as best as we can guess, all of the other copies must have been destroyed, and no new edition came out for another 4 years. We've already had a great deal of interest from Dutch collectors and Dutch libraries, because this is, again, it's quite rare to find something.
Right,
that
it's also part of their history.
Yes, it certainly is. So we're very excited about that. I mean, I could go on for. There's an amazing example, and you may or may not want your readers to know about it, but I'll tell you, in 1665 saw one of the most dramatic and perhaps tragic episodes in Jewish history with the arrival of the false Messiah Shabtai Tzvi.
Mm-hmm.
But when Shabtai Tzvi first announced his messiahship in the end of 1665, at the very beginning, many people were very, very excited. Before it was proven that he was the false Messiah, a great many people got very excited, and we have an incredibly rare copy of Rambam, a Yad Chazaka, a Mishneh Torah, where on the title page is an image of Shabtai Tzvi riding on a lion, and the colophon of the volume says Bishnat Moshiach Nagid. And it turns out when you do the calculations, the chronogram, you see that this book, which had a new title page put in at the last minute, it was typically the last thing to be done, was composed. The composition of this book took place only 3 weeks after the announcement of Shabtai Tzvi that he thought he was the Mashiach. So the rapidity with which the news spread from Gaza to Venice, mm-hmm, was incredible, and the excitement can be measured. Now, obviously, as you can imagine, most copies of this work, and certainly
must have been destroyed.
Well, mostly the title pages are certainly destroyed. There's a scholarly article in one of the bibliographic journals that describes how the Sabbatian references here were discovered.
There is also another interesting book, a medical tractate, that is both in Hebrew and with some Arabic. Can you tell us something about it?
Yes, we have a medical treatise written around the year 1452. It comes to us from the Sicilian community of Catania, and we know of a Jewish presence in Catania as early as the 4th century. We have a Hebrew tombstone from Catania, but by the Middle Ages, Catania was noted for its Samaritan population. We generally don't think of Shomronim or Samaritans outside the land of Israel,
right,
but there was a Samaritan population in Catania in Sicily, as well as a large number of Jewish physicians. This may have to do with the relaxed measures about learning medicine that took place there, but the work that we have is a compilation of medical treatises. Some are in Hebrew, some are in Arabic, written in Hebrew characters. We call that Judeo-Arabic, so that it's in Arabic because that was the vernacular language that people spoke, but Jews wrote it in Hebrew letters so that they could be able to read it, kind of transliteration, if you will.
Right.
This work would probably have been a textbook for an aspiring Jewish medical student. I had a young woman who asked me about the work upstairs, and I told her that in the 15th century there was an island in the Mediterranean. I said there was an island that was filled with Jewish doctors, and she said, "You mean besides Manhattan?"
So I guess Manhattan must have had its real origin back way.
But
in Sicily.
It's a fascinating book, and it has. It's not a beautiful book in terms of its physical beauty.
Right.
It shows its signs of age, and it has, in German we use the word Sammelband, which is a kind of compilation, mm-hmm, a hodgepodge of different there are different pieces of different texts probably which were used to stiffen the binding, but as an artifact, it is a fascinating, fascinating piece because it has all of these different, it has Arabic, Samaritan, Judeo-Arabic, Hebrew, and as a result, it's like taking a walk through time as you leaf through the pages. And it also is testimony to the strong involvement of Jews in the medical arts in the Middle Ages.
What else is there that is of special interest besides that three-inch Sefer Torah?
Well, as you mentioned, we have a very, very beautiful small Sefer Torah. It is not the smallest Sefer Torah. There are other Sefer Torah which have been written whose height is shorter than 3 inches. What makes this Sefer Torah so special is the beautiful proportionality of it. It has the Talmud calls for the height of the Sefer Torah to be 3 units as compared to the 2 for the circumference, which gives the Sefer Torah, when we look at a Sefer Torah, we generally think of, we have a certain image in our head. Most of the very small Sefer Torah that one finds, these kind of miniaturized Sefer Torah, are very, very stout and bulky on the sides, and they don't have the same aesthetic beauty. This Torah scroll is written on amazingly, amazingly thin parchment. The cloth is so, one could actually hold the cloth up and you know, you can see through it. I mean, you can't actually see through it, but you can see shadows on the other
right.
side. That's how beautifully delicate it is, and it looks like a Sefer Torah. It feels like a Sefer Torah. When one holds it, you don't feel like you're holding a curiosity. You rather feel as if you have been shrunk down to a miniature size, and there is a full-size Sefer Torah in front of you. That's kind of the feel you get. So I'm very, very enamored of that piece. I think that it's lovely. One of my favorite pieces in the entire auction is a fragment from an Aron Kodesh from the 11th century from Jobar, which is an outskirt of Damascus. This piece of a Torah ark is very, very rare. There is, however, I would draw your listeners' attention to the fact that currently at the Yeshiva University Museum, there is an exhibition of a complete Torah ark door from the Cairo Geniza, and it was one of our main abilities to authenticate this work, is to compare the truth is that this small fragment, which has survived, is obviously a much smaller piece. But when you look at the brilliant and beautiful inlay of the precious woods, I'm not sure if it's ivory or bone, and the ebony, and the remnants of the polychrome on the letters of the Tehillim engraved into the text, into the door, one can only begin to imagine how much care was taken to create this. It was collected in 1913 by a very, very famous Judaica collector. Many years after his death, his family offered the piece up for auction. But that piece, and I'll tell you just a little postscript bringing us to modern times, is that the synagogue in Jobar, outside of Damascus, survived for thousands of years and is a place of very, very important pilgrimage. Reports coming out of Syria in the last few months or even the last few weeks have reported that, you know, lo aleinu, the synagogue has been destroyed. I'm happy to say that I've received since then conflicting reports which told me the synagogue was only damaged but not completely destroyed. I guess until such time as it's safe again to travel
right.
to Damascus and near, you know, and to see the remnants of the Jewish patrimony, having this artifact from the synagogue of Jobar may be our last ability to relate to that. But I urge your listeners to please come and see it, or should someone want to have it in their own home, come and bid on it.
It is absolutely a beautiful piece. And since you mentioned ivory, you also have Passover scene with exquisite detail.
There is a very interesting piece. It's not in my department. It's in the silver department, although it's not silver, it's ivory. It is an ivory Passover compendium. And as far as we can tell, it looks to depict, I think, 4 or 5 Jews dressed in medieval costume standing around a Seder table, and on which there is the Korban Pesach. it doesn't seem to have been done by someone who is that familiar with an actual Seder. It was probably done by a non-Jewish artist, but it's interesting that the plaque in the front of it, I think, says Kodesh LaHashem or
Zepesach LaHashem.
Zepesach LaHashem. So that it was it's a sympathetic rendering, even if though it's not an accurate rendering. It shows the entire Korban Pesach sitting on, kind of on the table. I don't know what to make that piece. I think that we've cataloged it as 19th century. I think that the piece, when it was first created, wanted to hearken to an earlier time period. There's no claim that it is medieval, but it certainly depicts a medieval
definitely
style
the clothing is, yes.
Okay, thank you very, very much, David. As always, it's an absolute pleasure talking to you. And as always, once again, you have taught me quite a bit.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Frank.
And with me now is Jennifer Roth, Senior Vice President of Sotheby's New York. She will be talking to us on the artworks, on the paintings, and the criteria behind choosing the particular artists. As I went through the exhibit, I saw a plethora of styles, many borrowed from earlier painters and made more contemporary to the style, to the times of the actual painter. But there is a lot here that will remind you of much earlier paintings. It's quite obvious that every painter, every artist builds on what is before him. Good evening, Ms. Roth.
Good evening.
Tell us, what is the criteria about the paintings that were chosen? The paintings and some of the sculptures and videos.
Mm-hmm. Sotheby's basically tries to cover the full span of Israeli history of about 120 years from the years preceding the founding of the state, when among the new immigrants there were artists, of course, as well as every other profession, right through to the contemporary years. We aim for the highest quality works that we can possibly find, and we also are very much guided by what has been shown in the major museums as the best representations of Israeli art, Israeli and international art, because we also include Jewish artists of the École de Paris or the German Romantics, the German Expressionists, and so forth. But we, as I said, are very much following in the path of who the museum curators at the Israel Museum, the Tel Aviv Museum, have chosen as being the best representatives of Israeli art.
Some of the paintings, like, for example, Surrealist Samuel Beck, to me also seem to have political overtones. But there is no question that these were paintings done by somebody who was traumatized, who cannot take out of his mind the memories, the nightmares of the Holocaust.
Correct, yes, I fully agree with you. As we say in our note, he spent the war years in hiding, first in a Benedictine monastery, and then in the Vilna Ghetto, and finally in a labor camp, from which he finally managed to escape. He immigrated to Israel in 1948 and studied at the Bezalel Academy, but really has spent his entire life portraying his inner world, a world very much affected by his experiences in the Holocaust. And he's a surreal painter with a very unique and vivid imagination. We have a particularly fine group of works in the sale, including four or five from a West Coast estate, which have not been on the market for many, many years. So these are among the largest and the finest Vax to come to auction in a long time.
Going to the other extreme, I was particularly stricken by Moshe Gershuni's painting. There are two of them on this exhibition, particularly the large one, that monochrome one. The strokes were extremely powerful, and even though it's all basically shades of one color, gray, doesn't quite make it to black, it's all shades of gray, there is tremendous amount of information that I particularly see in that painting. Any comments?
I agree with you that it's a very, very beautiful painting. You're referring to Lot 86, an untitled work from 2005-2006, which in fact was exhibited in the Tel Aviv Museum's important Gershuni retrospective in 2010 to 2011. Another beautiful Gershuni is one from 1989, an earlier work in which colors do appear more in the purples and blues as opposed to the monochrome gray. I'm often reminded by what I heard a young Israeli artist say at the American Conference of Jewish Museums earlier this year, when this young Israeli was asked, is your art political? And he said, well, I think that my art is romantic, but everything behind my art is political. And I think that it's impossible for any artist to remain untouched by the political situation around them, and most artists in the world are in fact attuned to issues of the day, and that's what makes them great and memorable, is that they sort of take the pulse of what's happening in the world around them and manifest that for the current generation as well as for future generations.
Absolutely, and we see that even under communist Russia, some of their painters were very, very powerful and managed, in spite of all the repression, in spite of all the censorship, to put in their political message.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Even one who was considered a collaborator, Ephraim Altman, there is a lot of political stuff in his paintings, even though, quote-unquote, he towed the party line.
The party line, right. Well, Israelis don't toe any line, as you know.
That certainly is the case.
They are free, and thank goodness that we have this freedom in Israel. They're free to really just take the temperature of what's going on around them and to experiment and to let their own interpretation of life come through in their art. By no means, though, is all art overtly political in Israel. One takes, for example, the beautiful Sigalit Landau video called Dead Sea, and there are so many aspects of Israeli life and society in this video that perhaps just touch on the political but are really so much deeper as well. It's the combination of the sweetness and the tears that are part of Israeli life for everyone, the sweet watermelons contrasted with the saltiness of the Dead Sea, this beautiful spiral of watermelons that unravels just like our lives finally unravel in one long line. She is reaching for the exposed part of the fruit, the red, sweet part of the fruit, which is nonetheless in her video exposed to the bitterness of the salty sea, the way she herself has put her own figure into the spiral of watermelons and exposed herself to the harshness of the Israeli sun. You can interpret this in many different ways, but I think everybody has, or she certainly had a lot of recognition for this extremely powerful and beautiful meditative work on a part of the world that she feels very strongly about, the Dead Sea.
She's also represented by one of her sculptures, the woman playing music.
The harmonica, right.
Yes.
And both the Dead Sea video and this woman playing the harmonica were part of her her show, Endless Solution, in which she really, she mined history and did a lot of research on a on an early group of people who settled the area around the Dead Sea at the time of, you know, the writing of the Dead Sea Scrolls, or certainly maybe even earlier than that. And
in Qumran.
Yeah, in the area near Qumran, near the Dead Sea. And in her own description, she talks about these female figures as being laborers busy carrying out the chores of nomadic survival. But she uses unusual materials, particularly Haaretz newspapers that she has made into paper mache and printed and painted on. She literally, in the making of this exhibition, sort of withdrew from the world and simply got news of the world through her newspaper, which would arrive every day at her doorstep, and this somehow was incorporated into her art in the sculptures that she made for the exhibition.
When I was growing up in Uruguay, the two big Jewish painters who always spoke of
were Manet Katz and Rubin, and of course, Marc Chagall. I see that they are quite well represented here as well, at least Rubin and Katz. What can you tell us about them?
Well, we have a tremendous range of paintings by Reuven Rubin. It's really one of the best selections of work by this master that we've had in many years. Leading the selection is the wonderful painting of the Milkman from 1928, a joyous and beautiful view of the Israeli countryside coming to life and flowering under renewed Jewish settlement, which is the way Rubin saw the land as an immigrant himself, first in the teens and then when he settled in the 20s in Israel. He was completely enthralled with this wonderful transformation of the land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And of course, in the portrait of the milkman, there's a rather humorous aspect too, because the milkman's eye has been caught by this rather lovely dark-eyed and dark-haired maiden on the other side of the fence. And instead of paying attention to what he's doing, pouring milk from an urn into a jug or a cup, he is rather distracted, and in fact the milk is pouring out of his urn without him realizing it. And yet this gives Rubin the opportunity to express this wonderful abundance and the beauty of the land. The figure is completely surrounded by a halo of flowers. There are palm trees. There's a wonderful donkey who is enjoying some beautiful green leaves. And the whole thing is an evocation of this wonderful moment in Rubin's life, in Israel's life in the 20s, when there was such optimism. He himself had recently got married, and so the romantic nature of this painting and of much of his work at the time comes through from his own, I think, deep feelings of happiness and fulfillment.
And what I like about the representation of his work is that there are quite a few different styles. It shows
yes.
the evolution of the artist.
Absolutely. We also have a beautiful work from the 50s and then works from the 60s where the olive trees have attained this silvery glow, which was really a hallmark of Rubin's later style and for which he has been greatly praised. So there's some beautiful landscapes with these silvery olive trees. Also, one of my favorites is called Flowers on the Kinneret, which shows a still life of flowers, red and yellow flowers by a window overlooking the sea, and you see just sort of an element of a ruin or an old castle at the edge of the water with two boats. It's just a very typical view and very Israeli kind of feeling to the painting. And then one of my other favorites is The Wonderful Mother and Child. She's shown here with the pomegranates, again, a symbol of the fecundity, of the abundance of wonderful fruits in Jerusalem, shown together with a mother who is joyously holding her newborn baby.
Who holds up his hand in a very mischievous gesture.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, and going
Would
back
you
for
like
a second...
speak about any
yes.
of the paintings in the Judaic?
Yes, that's where I was going to, specifically the Oppenheim.
Great.
Oppenheim.
The Oppenheim is really our wonderful discovery.
Now that we have spoken about the Israeli exhibit, let's go back to the Great Judaica. There are two painters specifically that struck me with the feeling that they put in the characters they paint and with the power of their brushes. One of them is Isidor Kaufman with his portrait of a young rabbi. The other one is Oppenheim on his rendition of the infamous kidnapping of Edgardo Mortara.
Both quite moving in different ways. I love the portrait of the rabbi by Kaufman because it's very, very finely worked portrait. This is what collectors are looking for. He's also posed before a beautiful Torah art curtain, a parochet, which only, as far as I know, appears in one other painting by him, and that's the well-known Kaufman that belongs to the Tate Museum in London, and which is currently on view in London at the National Gallery in an extraordinary show called Vienna Portraits 1900. If anyone is going to London, I certainly recommend they see it. There's a huge number of portraits of Jewish art patrons. Jewish life is portrayed in painters as varied as Klimt, Schiele, Kokoschka, and then also this the beautiful Kaufman that they borrowed from the Tate. So it was very exciting for me to see that just a couple of weeks ago in England. But turning now to the Oppenheim, this was a real discovery because this painting has been lost for over 100 years. We know that it, at the time of Oppenheim's 100th anniversary memorial exhibition in 1900, the anniversary of his birth, the Kunstverein in Frankfurt was not able to exhibit the painting. They only exhibited a photograph. A well-known sketch, though, appears in that same catalog, and we've given a photograph of the sketch in our catalog, which shows that the painting very, very closely follows the arrangement of the figures in the sketch. It's a somewhat romanticized view of what happened on that awful night when there was a knock on the door and this Jewish family was completely surprised to find that the Bologna Inquisitor, they were living in Bologna, but the representative of the Pope, the Inquisitor in Bologna, was demanding that they give up their six-year-old son, Edgardo. When they tried to find out why, they were eventually told that this was because the child had been secretly baptized by a serving girl who had worked in the home many years before when Edgardo was only a baby. She had claimed that she was worried that he was mortally ill with a childhood illness and that he was going to die and that she should baptize him in order to save his soul. The family was absolutely shocked by this, but their protestations fell on deaf ears. The child was taken away from them and, in fact, was rebaptized and was brought up as a Catholic and eventually became a priest himself. He never returned to Judaism, and it caused an international outcry, this incident. It was a few years after the Damascus affair in Syria, where Sir Moses Montefiore had successfully interceded to win the liberty of a group of Jews who had been
falsely accused.
Yeah, but in this case, even Sir Moses Montefiore, who traveled to Rome to try and get an audience with the Pope, did not succeed, and he had to leave the city with his mission unfulfilled. The Rothschilds also tried to intercede. They were bankers to the Pope. There were Jewish leaders from all over the world, including America, but all over Europe too, who heard about the case and who petitioned to try and get Edgardo freed, but in fact he never was. Oppenheim was already a successful painter in Frankfurt in 1862 when he painted this painting 4 years after the kidnapping of the child, and it actually must have resonated with him because as a student in Rome he had been made aware by the Roman Jews of the actual fear that they felt of strangers. When he first arrived, they didn't realize he was a Jew and had sort of given him the cold shoulder. But eventually, as he got to know people, he was welcomed in the home of a Mr. Uzielli, but noticed that the women quickly shooed the children out of the room when they saw a stranger entering the house. So this was actually a real fear that Italian Jews lived with right up until this incident in the 1860s. Mm-hmm. A few years later, the Risorgimento of Garibaldi and King Victor Emmanuel succeeded in bringing about the unification of Italy, and the papal authority over Bologna and a lot of the papal lands, was eroded.
Mm-hmm. Now, what other paintings are there in the Judaica area that are particularly interesting?
I would simply draw attention to, there are several that I like very much, but the Alfred Aaron Walmark is an interesting painting. Here we have a British artist who had arrived from Warsaw in London in 1893. He had come from a very traditional family, and unlike other Jewish artists who sort of went away from Jewish themes, he stayed very close to his background and continued to paint scenes of the shtetl and of did many portraits of rabbis and religious Jews. This is a wonderful painting called East and West. It's estimated at $20,000 to $30,000, and it shows both a Ashkenazi Jew and a Sephardic Jew praying near one another in a synagogue or studying together.
It's in a style quite reminiscent of Rembrandt.
Yes, his great mentor, as he said, his great inspiration was Rembrandt, and his paintings often have this wonderful contrast of dark tones and light emanating from a certain point in outside the canvas.
There are also some whimsical sketches, like, for example, Georg Opitz.
Right. Opitz was a non-Jewish artist, but some of your listeners may remember that in the Steinhardt sale in April of this year, we had a very major Opitz showing the Jewish marketplace in Prague. Mm-hmm. In this case, so he is known to have depicted Jewish subjects. It's signed, and they're both signed, and one of the watercolors shows a group of naughty children in the schoolroom making fun of their teacher behind his back. I think that still happens to
even
this
today.
Very day. Yeah. Certainly when my son went to yeshiva, it was not uncommon. And then the other one seems to represent a family where a daughter is presenting her suitor to her parents, and the mother is sort of interceding with the father to perhaps look kindly on this match. So just charming and beautifully rendered drawings by quite a well-known artist of the 19th century. So those are my favorites, and certainly encourage everyone, if they can, to come in and see the exhibition before we close on
Absolutely.
Monday.
Absolutely, and the exhibition is on through Monday.
Thank you.
This is Chaim Schmidt bidding you all a good evening, and tune us in next time. Thank you very much for listening, and come back to hear us again. Thank you, Ms. Roth.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye now.
My pleasure.